Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we explore the stories of Appalachians who are moved to spread love, not hate. In West Virginia, a racist hate crime shakes a community to spread a message of tolerance.
People are thinking about where they can go or where they can be and where they'll be welcomed and where they'll be celebrated. I wanted them to think of Hillsboro.
And a Kentucky songwriter's high lonesome tune is inspired by a gay coal miner's true story.
First things first, I'm a blue collar man with scars on my knuckles, dust on my hands. Probably wouldn't have ever known I've got a man waiting on me at home.
As a gay man who grew up in Southwest Virginia, I have to claim my whole self.
And ain't we brothers too?
Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This past week, our country celebrated Martin Luther King Jr. Day with a new discovery, a rarely heard speech Martin Luther King Jr. made in 1965 at the UCLA campus. A recent grad student and his professor found it in a cabinet while gathering tapes of old speeches. Here's a piece of that speech.
Not only we've come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go before the problem of racial injustice is solved. I don't think I have to stay on this point too long. We need only turn on our televisions and open our newspapers and look around in our communities. And we know that no section of our country can boast of clean hands in the area of brotherhood.
That speech was aired earlier this week on NPR's Morning Edition in honor of MLK Day. Today we're looking at how those words King spoke back in 1965 still overshadow the civil rights struggles for many people in Appalachia. Later in the show, we'll hear from people who struggle with discrimination in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community in Appalachia. But first, we'll hear about how a recent racist hate crime in West Virginia has inspired a rural community to spread a new message of tolerance. 40-year-old Robert Ratliff admitted to using fluorescent green paint in the middle of the night to write two words on the side of the town's only restaurant, the Pretty Penny Cafe. Our producer Roxy Todd reports that to Hillsboro, those two words have had a ripple effect of emotions, from shock to fear to pain, and now to love.
For years, the Pretty Penny Cafe has been a fixture of the Hillsboro community. It's located in a historic building that was originally the local general store 100 years ago. On a recent morning, the restaurant's owner, Blair Campbell, and the rest of the Hillsboro community awoke to see two words painted on the side of the Pretty Penny. Two words, the N-word, followed by the word lover, attacking Blair and her husband, Charlon.
Somebody had just decided they wanted to be really hateful and ugly and write how much they protested the relationship I have with my husband, who's a Jamaican and a black man. And so they took it upon themselves to target me, to cause me hurt. And it really hurt me.
Those two words expressed hate. They also expressed a very hateful message about Blair's marriage to a black man.
It's about loving somebody, and it's so hateful. And that's the problem. You know, like, how do you do that with the word love in there?
Racism is not new to Hillsboro. In the 1980s, a neo-Nazi organization called the National Alliance moved its compound to West Virginia, just a few miles outside Hillsboro. But the Alliance's leader, William Pierce, died in 2002. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, after William Pierce died, the Alliance had lost most of its members and financial backing. But this neo-Nazi organization, however small, is still officially based in the woods a few miles outside of Hillsboro. Sarah Riley grew up a few miles away from the compound. She's white, but she remembers being very afraid of the people who were in the National Alliance, who she refers to as skinheads.
I think a lot of people think of Hillsboro as a place where there's a lot of racism, you know, because the National Alliance used to be really strong here. It's a white supremacist group. I remember growing up being really scared of skinheads and of, like, what if they came after you? And, like, I just don't feel scared anymore. 20 years later, I don't feel scared. I think it's a different time. I think we're a different place. I think we walk together. And I think it's time everybody in the world knew that.
A few days after the hate crime was committed, a group of concerned residents gathered at a Hillsboro church. Over 100 people showed up. That's a lot of people for a town with a population of about 250. They brought ceramic bowls of casserole, salads, mac and cheese, and dozens of pies. They sat together and talked for hours. Some people were stunned, saying they couldn't believe something like that could happen in Hillsboro. Others, like Hope May, say this community needs to have a real conversation about racial diversity. Hope is biracial and remembers when she was growing up in the nearby town of Marlinton, she lost several white friends when their parents found out one of her parents was black. It was worse, she says, for her brother.
He doesn't come here at all because of the torment and the hell that he was put through as a small child here. He will not have his children in this community, nor himself.
And while she's noticed improvements, racism is still a problem for her biracial daughter, Gabrielle.
I want her to grow up here safe and hopefully non-racist environment where people are just people and they're a community and they take care of each other, period, no matter what. Sorry, he's handful.
About halfway through that potluck, a Pocahontas County police officer stopped by to inform Blair that they were headed to arrest a suspect.
Our neighboring county to pick him up, take him into custody now.
40-year-old Robert Ratliff of Greenbrier County was then arrested under the state statute for a hate crime. He confessed and said he had acted alone. He claimed that he had a personal grudge against Blair that had nothing to do with racism. There is no evidence at this time to suggest he's a member of the National Alliance or another hate group. Still, it was an undeniable act of hate, one that hurt Blair and her family, and has shaken the community into action. To celebrate diversity and tolerance, Hillsboro community members like Hope May are rallying behind a new campaign called We Are One.
When people are thinking about where they can go or where they can be and where they'll be welcomed and where they'll be celebrated, I wanted them to think of Hillsboro.
Sarah Riley and Blair Campbell helped launch the campaign in response to the hate crime. Sarah says there is racism here, and that needs to be confronted with love and as a community.
The night after the graffiti appeared on the Pretty Penny, Charlene's cousin, Fitzroy, moved here from Jamaica. Fitzroy said, you know, when I was on my way here, my mom was upset. She was nervous. She was praying for me, you know, worried for my safety. And we had just a small potluck that night to welcome Fitzroy and process anything. And he said, now that I'm here, I feel so welcome. My mama says to tell you, she's so happy.
That's the kind of tolerance and diversity that Sarah, Blair, and other Hillsboro residents hope they can encourage with the We Are One campaign. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Hillsboro.
Blair says she's looking forward to the Bob Marley Birthday Bash. It's an annual event held every year at the Pretty Penny Cafe. This year, on February 7th, the restaurant will be serving Jamaican food all day, and there will be live music. On WVPublic.org, we've posted more information about Hillsboro's new campaign to promote diversity.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Based in the mountains of eastern Tennessee, a place known as the Highlander Center has been a kind of melting pot of ideas. For over 80 years, people have come to Highlander to learn to promote social justice and racial tolerance. It's probably better known for its role in the civil rights era, when such movement icons as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks passed through its doors. Back in 2007, the Highlander Center was celebrating its 75th anniversary. NPR's Audie Cornish was there, and she recorded this story about the Highlander Center's future, present, and past.
In 1932, the Highlander Folk Center started out an adult education program for the poor in the foothills of Appalachia. But from the start, its curriculum was unusual. No books, no tests, and no professors, says George Barrett.
These are 1 and 2 week intensive courses on such things as parliamentary law, how to conduct a meeting, how to organize, how to run a local union, how to keep the books so you don't get in trouble. And sort of those sort of things infused with the spirit of solidarity.
Barrett attended residential seminars and later became the center's lawyer. Highlander was infamous for its aggressive role in the Southern labor movement, supporting coal mining strikes, train porter unions, and more. The school was designed to bring poor people together to discuss the problems in their communities, then share stories and ideas on how to change things. As a result, Highlander was one of a few integrated places in the South.
Growing up in rural Alabama, I had never had an opportunity to be involved in an interracial setting, not even to have a meal with another person of another race.
That's Georgia Congressman John Lewis. He says Highlander was a place people could come together without fear.
Long before we started sitting in, long before we went on a freedom ride, some of us got our foundation, got our beginning, our start at Highlander.
In 1952, Highlander began adding how-to seminars on passive resistance and voter registration drives. In doing so, it became one of the educational centers of the civil rights movement, says history professor John Glenn of Indiana's Ball State University.
I think its place in Southern history is that it represents an alternative to the generalization that all white Southerners were opposed to labor unions. All white Southerners were opposed to racial integration. All white Southerners are in support of economic development, no matter what the cost. And Highlander represents an alternative.
When Congressman Lewis visited, he was a college student in Nashville who became involved in lunch counter protests and SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. There, he sat elbow to elbow with civil rights leaders such as Dr. Martin Luther King, Julian Bond, and Ralph Abernathy.
We shall overcome.
And if you recognize this song, you've been touched by the work of the school as well. Because the protest lyrics to this gospel tune were developed and spread through pupils of Highlander. As a result, the school became a lightning rod for segregationists who condemned it a radical breeding ground. The school's former attorney, George Barrett, says the Klan attacked the staff, the state police raided it, and nearby governors railed against it.
You had bubbling up in the South all these sort of sovereignty commissions and all that who were going to keep us all pure and white and save us from the communists. And Highlander became a focal point for them to zero in on because of the labor connections and the civil rights connections.
After congressional and state investigative hearings, Tennessee officials shut Highlander down on charges it was improperly run. The school's founder died in 1990, but in a 1981 television interview, Miles Horton recalled the day when the police closed it down.
I said, what are you laughing about? I said, my friend here, you know, he thinks he's padlocking Highlander. But I said, you know, Highlander's an idea. You can't padlock an idea.
Horton reopened it as the Highlander Research and Education Center, and it has outlived its segregationist foes. Today, there's an annual teen activist camp. Seminars on bilingual labor organizing, immigration, globalization, lesbian and gay rights, and environmental issues. It seems scattershot, but Highlander's new director, Pam McMichael, disagrees.
It's a recurring conversation because the kind of moments shift, and good organizing is knowing when you shift with those moments and what are the next moments coming that you need to pay attention to, that you can both be a catalyst to and also support.
No doubt, McMichael says, there'll be a lot of discussion this weekend about where the Highlander Center is going and why. But that, too, is part of its tradition. Audie Cornish, NPR News, Nashville.
Since that story first aired back in 2007, the Highlander Center has launched a new program called the Appalachian Transition Fellowship. The fellowship connects emerging young leaders in Appalachia with host communities. Together, they work on projects that can support a sustainable economic transition in Appalachia. 13 fellows are currently working in West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, Ohio, and Virginia. We've posted a link where you can learn more on our website. One question we've been hearing in the national news lately is whether different groups of people can sometimes receive different treatment by our justice system. And it's not just a matter of race. Some children in rural areas, especially in West Virginia, might be at a disadvantage in our country. While the U.S. has cut its juvenile incarceration rate by half, West Virginia's rate is 42% higher than the rest of the country. The Mountain State has also seen the largest increase in youth incarceration since 2001. Dana Goldstein wanted to find out why. She's the author of The Teacher Wars, a history of America's most embattled profession, and a staff writer for the Marshall Project, where she covers the school-to-prison pipeline. Her latest investigation, No Country for Young Men, tells the story of Junior Smith, a young man from Phillippi, West Virginia, who got caught up in the juvenile detention system at the age of 17. John Hockenberry of PRI's The Takeaway caught up with Dana Goldstein last October to talk about her investigation into West Virginia's juvenile justice system.
So what's going on in West Virginia, and the story that you discovered there in some ways is a story of child advocacy on the part of one mom?
A few different things are happening in West Virginia. The state has really looked very carefully at school truancy, so kids cutting school. And what they've done is to address that, they've put police officers within middle schools and high schools. And what I found, which was the case for Junior Smith, the young man I profile in the piece, is that when you start to have contact with law enforcement, say underage drinking or something that might be considered pretty minor in another state, just the simple act of having the police officer working in the school means you're going to keep coming into contact with law enforcement. And what builds up is quite a long rap sheet. And eventually you could end up getting incarcerated for a series of things that in and of themselves are quite small.
Do you think that the presence of police criminalizes what are in fact acting out kinds of behaviors in the course of a normal high school?
Well, certainly a violent fight between two young men is going to be a problem at any school. But what I saw in West Virginia as I worked on this story over the course of several months is that the schools have in many cases just outsourced discipline to these county police officers. And when that happens, a type of scuffle between two young men that a principal might deal with in another setting can sometimes get referred straight to a judge.
And so suddenly these young people are in the system, whereas they might have been buffered in other states or at another time. Tell me the story of Junior Smith.
Yeah. So Junior Smith first came into contact with law enforcement for underage drinking in middle school. But he had a series of problems that were driven in many cases by substance abuse, none of which were that serious in and of themselves. The most serious thing that happened to him is that he walked into the unlocked garage of a neighbor. He said he was looking for a six-pack of beer. He didn't find one. He didn't actually enter the house. But after this, he did, you know, get put in a court supervision period. And during the court supervision period, he got into a scuffle, a little fight with another boy in class. It wasn't anything that caused anyone any lasting injury, but this was reported to the judge, and he was at that point incarcerated. He waited 3 months for a hearing, so not the sort of due process that we're used to in the adult system. And then when he finally did have a hearing, he was sentenced at age 17 to be incarcerated until the age of 21, ultimately, after his mom became an advocate and he showed good behavior within the juvenile facility, he was let out after 13 months.
Let's talk about the cycle that really led to his incarceration. I mean, while there might have been an argument for every single incident for doing something, when you add it all up, it certainly means that he's headed for a hopeless kind of situation that will only be prison.
Yeah, well, one of the things that didn't happen for him is that he never received the sort of evidence-backed interventions that other states have tried successfully to prevent juveniles from becoming incarcerated. He never received family therapy. He didn't receive substance abuse treatment, any of these things might have diverted him away from incarcerated facility and helped him get back on track. His parents were, you know, very eager to help him straighten out. What they found is that in their very remote and rural part of West Virginia, there could be a 3-month waiting period for an outpatient drug treatment program. So what I look at in the piece is, what have other rural states specifically done to address this?
Does West Virginia have unique geographic problems in delivering these kinds of services, do you think?
Well, it's one of the most mountainous and remote states in the country. It's one of the poorest states in the country. So it definitely has a small workforce that's actually qualified to deliver these services to kids. But what I found is that places like Ohio and Georgia, they're paying service providers to bring these services to kids within their homes, and that is a very promising model for a rural state.
And Ohio is adjacent to West Virginia.
Yes, it is.
So it's not far away. Tell me about Junior Smith's mom and what kind of an advocate she is and what she hopes to do to change things in West Virginia.
Well, she was just stunned that her son was incarcerated for 13 months and was given actually a nearly 4-year sentence for what she really saw as a string of petty misbehaviors. Her child was actually never put on probation. Probation is a period of time in West Virginia and many other states where a juvenile might receive services to help them get back on track in school and life, deal with substance abuse problems. That never happened for him, in part because these very strict anti-truancy laws in West Virginia that state that you are truant if you miss more than 5 days of school, which is really a small number, has so overloaded the probation system that for a kid who's drinking and doing drugs and maybe fighting in school, like Junior Smith, there's no room for them within probation.
Did you ever miss 5 days of school when you were in middle school or high school?
Sure.
I think
many of us did.
In a row? Did you ever walk into a garage looking for a six-pack of beer?
Yeah, no, I never did that. And I think that was the interesting thing is reading the comments on the piece and hearing feedback to it since it came out. A lot of people were very eager to judge what he did, all of which was completely unacceptable. And even punching another kid, that's unacceptable too. But what is the school doing and what is the justice system doing to address it? Because we know it is ineffective to incarcerate a young person. He was assessed by the state and they found he was at moderate risk. A moderate risk kid is going to have better outcomes, research shows, on probation than incarcerated.
So when people judge Junior Smith as a bad kid, they can do that and they can have their own arguments and compelling arguments for doing that. But there are social consequences when you simply declare someone a bad kid in the system.
Yeah, and there's consequences for the taxpayer because it costs $80,000 to $100,000 per year to incarcerate a kid like Junior and maybe $33,000 per year, research shows, to give him the services that are going to be more effective in preventing him from becoming an adult offender down the line.
Dana Goldstein is staff writer for the Marshall Project, author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Thanks so much, Dana.
Thank you.
That was John Hockenberry of The Takeaway, talking with Dana Goldstein. Since this report first aired last October, West Virginia's Intergovernmental Task Force has been exploring ways to change these statistics within the state's juvenile justice system. Last year, the task force released a report, which includes 20 recommendations on how to reduce the state's incarcerated youth population. The report focuses heavily on preventative measures to deal with status offenders or juveniles who commit offenses that would not be considered crimes for an adult. Governor Tomlin is expected to introduce a state bill encompassing those recommendations sometime next week. That's the cue. I'm supposed to say, it's time for What's in a Name? But for real, folks, this segment really is a lot of fun. We ask, how in the heck did a town get that name? So, what town in Kentucky got its name by shortening the name of the Virginia Coal Company? We'll have the answer after the break. This is Inside Appalachia. your Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. So back to our What's in a Name quest. What city got its name by shortening the name of the company that founded it? The Virginia Coal Company. Vico, Kentucky. And for this segment, we want to go deeper inside Appalachia to find a story even beyond the story of its name. In January 2013, Vico, Kentucky became the smallest town in America to pass an LGBT anti-discrimination law, with a population just over 300. You see, while we have laws protecting against discrimination for gender or race, there's no federal law that prevents discrimination for sexual orientation. Last year, one of the co-creators of the show, Will and Grace, Matt Muchnick, heard about Vico's new ordinance and was inspired to donate a playground to the city. As that playground was being built, a team of producers from The Hollywood Reporter traveled to Vico to make a short film. They were there when the new playground broke ground. They talked with residents to talk about the city's decision to make it illegal to discriminate against the gay community in their city limits.
My name is Claude Branson, Jr. I'm a city commissioner of the city of Vico in Perry County in Kentucky. I'm one of the city commissioners that passed the fairness ordinance. We knew our mayor was gay, and that's okay with us. I see nothing wrong with it. You know, all people's equal.
This community started as a coal company. That's how it got its name, the Virginia Coal Company. That's how Vico got its name. They abbreviated it. And it's all built around coal. And in the 60s and the 50s, when this place had plenty of coal mines going on 24 hours a day and thousands upon thousands of jobs and coal camps all over the place, this place was booming. But now it's nearly a ghost town. And this used to be a major community. And it's on the way back up again, whether or not coal is.
We're dedicating a park that was donated from California. And we're really grateful for that donation, because most of the money, as far as the coal fields and the coal business, they've took the money and left, and left us with nothing. And ironically, you get somebody out of California that will donate instead of the local entrepreneurs and invest back into the community. And we really appreciate the donations that these people give.
My name is Max Muchnick, and I am the father, one of the fathers of Rose and Evan Hyman Muchnick, and we're standing in the Rose and Evan playground in Vico, Kentucky. I'm from Los Angeles, California. That's where I live with my legally appointed husband. About a year ago, I read an article in the New York Times about a mayor in a small town in Kentucky who passed an anti-discrimination ordinance, and I was really impressed, and I talked to my husband about it, and I said, we have to do something for that little town.
After we learned about Vico and we learned about what the people of Vico were doing, really, we actually just wanted some kind of association with Vico. We thought it was so fantastic, you know. So Max called Johnny, and they talked on the phone, and we wanted to get to know Vico and kind of help out the community or be part of the community in some way. And part of that conversation was, maybe it would be nice to have a playground here. We don't have one. So we said, well, let's make that happen. We did.
The Fairness Ordinance protects everybody, transgender, transsexual, homosexual, black, white, female, male, anybody, everything. So, you know, they can't be fired from their job or evicted from their housing, and everyone is treated equally.
When we passed the ordinance, you know, we had flack from both sides. You know, people that was, you know, old country people that, you know, don't believe in gay and all this and equality. But look, times have changed. It's a new reality.
It hadn't been passed. I think Kentucky, when we did it, only had three, and then we did it and it became the smallest town in the United States to pass a fairness ordinance. It's changed the viewpoints on how people look at Eastern Kentucky and Appalachia, and you know that we're not that closed-minded and we're not of lesser intelligence. And you know, so in that way, it's been a great thing. Anytime you can help other people, it just makes you feel awesome.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out.
You know, when we did the Fairness Ordinance, it just spread love and
acceptance all across the nation. And Max and Eric are two of the guys that showed that love back, you know. And so we really appreciate everything they've done for VICO. And we can't tell you how much we think of y'all. It's just awesome.
And we just want to say that we are so proud to be here today. And we want to thank the mayor for making this all happen, because we're standing here because of Mayor Cummings. You know, as the saying goes, so goes VICO, so goes the country, or at least that's the way I want to see it. And congratulations to all of you. You're fantastic people. We could not be prouder to be here today. So thank you very much. Thank you, Mayor.
Everybody's equal. Nobody's better than nobody else. Rich or poor, don't matter. That's the way we think around here. That's the way it should be.
We've had so many cards and letters and donations, you know, for what we did, and it's helped the city out in so many different ways, and which hopefully it just helped us continue to grow and get better.
That last voice was Mayor Johnny Cummings of VICO, Kentucky. We checked in with Cummings this week to find out how the town has been doing since it first passed its anti-discrimination ordinance back in 2013. Cummings said there are a couple of new smaller businesses that have opened in town, and there's talk of a possible new legal moonshine distillery that could come to VICO. 7 cities in Kentucky now have LGBT anti-discrimination ordinances, like VICO's. The town of Berea, Kentucky, voted against this type of ordinance last fall.
If I can make a song out of this heavy heart of mine, it would sound like going home on a sweet Virginia night.
The voice you're hearing is Sam Gleaves. He's a musician who grew up playing old-time mountain music in southwestern Virginia. His songs have a high, lonesome, old-time sound. Their roots are deep in Appalachia. And the stories they tell explore some bitter truths about how hard it can be to be different here. Our producer, Roxy Todd, met up with Sam Gleaves to talk about one song in particular, a song that tells a true story.
Sam Gleaves says he's been drawn to music since he was a kid in Wytheville, Virginia. He loved to listen to Bob Dylan and Stevie Nicks.
I was always interested in songs that told stories about real people and real emotion, you know, so I was drawn to folk music.
When he was 12, Gleaves got a guitar and started playing along with the radio, picking out the chords.
I'd been teaching myself to play the guitar for about a year or so, and my mom said, well, there's a fella in a rural retreat, she said, there's a fellow over there that teaches music lessons in his barber shop, and sort of in between haircuts, you know. So I went in his barber shop for the first time, and there were two young men sitting there playing fiddle and banjo, playing an old dance tune. And I had never seen that, you know, up close and personal in that way. And to think that it was two young, you know, two guys my age just sitting there playing this old tune was really amazing to me.
He started taking lessons from that barber, an old-time musician whose name is Jim Lloyd.
And so he showed me really what old-time mountain music was. And he introduced me to a lot of his friends and people that had mentored him. And he'd take me around with him when he traveled to fiddlers' conventions or concerts he was going to or places that he was performing at, or even to the recording studio.
Last spring, Sam Gleaves graduated from Berea College, where he studied oral history and played in the college's bluegrass band. Now he's turning his attention towards something other than old-time music. He's producing an album of original songs. The title song is based on the true story of a coal miner from West Virginia who was harassed and threatened at work after his coworkers discovered he was gay.
I was born here just the same as you. Another time, another day. I'm sure the good Lord took his time, made each of us just this way. walk beside you step by step, and it never crossed my mind that I would grow up one of the different kind.
I wanted to write the song about what it means to be a man. LGBTQ folks in Appalachia have a particularly complex identity because there's modern queer culture, which is very urban-centered and very young feeling in a lot of ways. And then there's what we think about Appalachian culture having deep roots, you know, and being rural and having gender roles that a lot of us feel restricted by. But then you have people that belong to both of those identities. Like, as a gay man who grew up in Southwest Virginia, I have to claim my whole self. And ain't we brothers too?
The coal miner who inspired this song recently sent Sam Gleaves an email telling him how much he enjoyed hearing this song.
That is a powerful song.
That's the coal miner, Sam Williams. He used to be known as Sam Hall. He married his partner, Burley Williams, back in 2010 and recently took his husband's name. They live in a small town a few miles outside of Charleston, West Virginia. In the evening after work, they cook burritos together. Then they settle into their living room. Sam Williams is on a beanbag chair playing with his dog, Lacey, who is a stray that they adopted together about 5 years ago.
You days, girl. Give day 11. Yes, you days, girl.
You days, love bug. Here, you want back up here in your chair? Come on.
Sam Williams is not a coal miner anymore. He quit Massey Energy in 2010 after working as a miner for 7 years. He tells me about what happened when his coworkers found out he was gay.
Not that I ever even told them that I was gay. They just took it upon themselves to watch, follow, see me come out of a bar, automatically stereotype me. I faced a lot of things in the mines. I've been told that they hope all faggots die. There's a fine line from somebody saying that they're joking and then looking you in the eye and saying it and knowing that that's what they meant. But when it's your supervisors, it's a whole different ballgame.
Sam Williams is 32 years old, tall and muscular, with hands that are chiseled from the 7 years they've spent cutting coal from these hills. He says he was touched by the song that tells the story of what happened to him in the mines.
I loved it because when he comes on there and he says, you know, I come home to my man or my husband or...
You never know. I think I got a man waiting on me at home or something.
Yes.
First things first, I'm a blue-collar man with scars on my knuckles, dust on my hands. Probably wouldn't have ever known I've got a man waiting on me at home.
That relates to me so much because I know that Burley was waiting for me at home. I mean, he would wait up for me until we got in, and then he'd have dinner waiting on me, even though if I'd got in at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know.
Burley and Sam Williams have lived together since 2009. The first years they were dating, Sam Williams was dealing with the worst of the harassment and threats from his coworkers. Burley says there were nights when he feared for Sam's life.
And they messed with his vehicle, like scratched and quit fag, took the wheel weights off his tires. It was nerve-wracking because I never knew when he was coming home, and when he didn't come home, I had to go out and drive, go to mines and search for him. I'm thinking someone shot him on the side of the road.
Burley says Sam's coworkers even came to their house late at night to bang on their door. To protect himself and Sam, Burley bought his very first gun. He also got a concealed weapon permit in case they were ever confronted when they were out in public.
You always know there's hate out there. There's individually people that will never be accepting of gay individuals just because of who they are. So you do have to take precautions to protect yourself and your family and your loved ones.
Sam Williams finally had had enough, and he quit his job in 2010. He sued his former employer, Massey Energy, for sexual harassment. He couldn't sue for discrimination because in West Virginia, it's legal to discriminate against gay people. State law prohibits discriminating against people on the basis of sex or race, but the law doesn't include sexual orientation. The same is true of other states in Appalachia, like Virginia and Kentucky. Andrew Schneider is the executive director of Fairness West Virginia, a gay rights advocacy group. The group is trying to pass a law that would make it illegal to discriminate against an employee based on sexual orientation or gender identity.
It's particularly, I think, risky now that we have marriage equality, because you can get married on Sunday and then fired on Monday. And what I mean by that is marriage, in some ways, makes our relationships in the gay community more visible. And so you are more prone to have the picture of your loved one on your desk. You want to talk with coworkers about what you did with your family over the weekend.
Oh, that's interesting. So we're in a weird transition phase where it's becoming more socially acceptable, but at the same time, it's almost like people in the LGBT community are more vulnerable to discrimination.
And in some ways, it wasn't expected. We never expected we would get marriage before we got non-discrimination.
Even without that legal protection, Sam Williams was able to get a settlement from his former employer. In 2011, Massey Energy was bought out by Alpha Natural Resources, and the new owners agreed to settle Sam's case out of court. Alpha declined to comment on the case, but they did send an email saying the company is committed to a workplace that is free of discrimination and where all employees, no matter their gender identity or sexual orientation, are treated fairly and with respect. Still, Sam Williams says he doesn't think it would be safe to go back to mining. Now he works as a manager at a Dollar General.
I do miss running Good Coal. I miss, you know, being top dogs on the coal crew and before things started getting more violent. If there was a perfect world out there, I'd love to be another coal. I mean, I'd love to be a coal miner again, but it'll never happen again, more than likely. But it was fun.
But it wasn't fun. Once he had to look over his shoulder all the time, worried that somebody he worked with would follow through in their threats to kill him. Even years later, Sam Williams still seems hurt that the people he thought were his close friends turned against him. In Sam Gleaves' song about him, the coal miner has a conversation with his co-workers. In the song, the miner tells them that he's still the true West Virginian he always was. That doesn't change just because he's gay.
To tell you the truth, I don't want to fight. Just want to say one thing I'll write to you. Ain't we flesh and blood all through? And ain't we brothers too? I took a job and worked right by you. Walked down in that hole beside you. Thought I heard some whisper sound. Got found out, word got around. Got made out for something I'm not. Called everything but a child of God. Didn't mind to show it out in the parking lot. So I cut my coal with my head hung down. Just like a stranger in my own town. Got bitter day by day. Went home every night with the mess they made. First things first, I'm a blue-collar man. With scars on my knuckles, dust on my hands. Probably wouldn't have ever known I've got a man waiting on me at home. To tell you the truth, I don't want to fight. Just want to say one thing I'll write to you. Ain't we flesh and blood all through? And ain't we brothers too? Tell me I'm not man enough to set foot in that mine. Go on and tell me that once more. My face this time. tell you the truth, I don't want to fight. Just want to say one thing out right to you. Ain't we flesh and blood all through? And ain't we brothers too?
That song was called Ain't We Brothers by Sam Gleaves. You can find more information about his music and the story of former coal miner Sam Williams on our website, wvpublic.org. Today on Inside Appalachia, we've been hearing from people in our region who've been faced with discrimination. Civil rights go beyond issues of racial injustice. LGBT discrimination continues for many people in Appalachia. But these last 2 years have certainly seen some sweeping changes for laws allowing same-sex couples to marry. In Appalachia, gay marriage has become legal in West Virginia, Virginia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania after court decisions. States that have banned gay marriage by law include Kentucky and Tennessee. And last week, the U.S. Supreme Court announced that by this June, it would review lower court rulings on gay marriage. That means the Supreme Court will decide whether the state bans on gay marriage are constitutional. LGBT advocacy groups in Kentucky have been asking the Supreme Court to look at this issue. And WUKY's Josh James reports that supporters and opponents of same-sex marriage in Kentucky are reacting to the news that the Supreme Court now appears poised to settle the issue.
LGBT couples across Kentucky and the entire nation have been waiting for this day, some of them their whole lives.
Chris Hartman, director of the Kentucky Fairness Campaign, reacting to the announcement Friday that the highest court in the nation will take up an appellate ruling that upheld bans in Kentucky and three other states. He says he's optimistic a ruling for gay marriage advocates is at hand, and he's basing that optimism on the court's previous actions or lack thereof.
Certainly there is a bit of trepidation. There's never a way to know for certain which way justices will rule. But the Supreme Court's actions up to this point, not just with the Windsor ruling, but then deciding not to rule on several of the cases that came before it, which opened the door for the freedom to marry in many more states, it would seem incredibly unlikely that the Supreme Court will start moving backwards on this issue.
The move came as a bit of a surprise, however, for Kent Ostrander with the Family Foundation, an organization that opposes same-sex marriage.
I actually thought they would wait for the Sixth Circuit to weigh in, and maybe even the 11th Circuit. That way the nation would be pretty well represented. At this point, only the Sixth Circuit has ruled in favor of traditional marriage. And so I would have thought the case would have been more ripe if they had waited another 6 months.
Ostrander says he agrees that the Supreme Court's recent passive rulings, which allowed judges to strike down a series of bans across the country, could bode well for his opponents. But he says he's also hopeful the court will ultimately decide to honor the wishes of states that enacted the bans. In a statement released Friday, Governor Steve Beshear said the court made the right decision and any further delay would, quote, prolong the instability and uncertainty which states and families currently endure, end quote. Josh James, WUKY News.
Same-sex marriages are legal in North Carolina, but a lawmaker is planning to introduce a religious freedom bill. One goal would be to give magistrates a way to opt out of performing same-sex weddings. And Virginia State Delegate Bob Marshall just introduced a new bill that's being called the Anti-Gay Discrimination Bill. If passed, this bill would make it legal for schools, restaurants, hospitals, and hotels to turn people away if they are gay. Many advocates of bans against same-sex marriage quote religious opposition to homosexuality. But a Kentucky Baptist pastor has said that he supports gay marriage. Last November, the Kentucky Baptist Convention voted to sever ties with the Louisville Church after its decision to support homosexuality. Crescent Hill Baptist Church announced last year that sexual orientation and gender identity would not be a factor in hiring, ordinations, or performing marriage services. Executive Director Paul Chitwood says the vote to disassociate from the church was difficult but necessary.
We are grieved by the necessity of that decision. However, given the fact that Crescent Hill has chosen to affirm homosexuality, it really places them outside of the Bible's teaching, outside of Baptist beliefs.
Crescent Hill pastor Jason Crosby maintains the Bible doesn't explicitly condemn homosexuality.
In addition to that, we concluded that Jesus' clear instruction to love others as ourselves is what drew us to reach the conclusion that we would fully welcome and affirm lesbian and gay individuals here at the church.
Crosby wrote on his church's website that he's spoken to closeted LGBT people who shared that they had seriously pondered suicide. Pastor Crosby wrote that, quote, "Tragically, many others have acted upon this impulse." Crescent Hill Church says on its website that it welcomes LGBT people to its church and will perform same-sex marriages. As a closing thought about tolerance and diversity in Appalachia, here's Claude Branson Jr., one of the city commissioners who helped pass the anti-discrimination law in Vico, Kentucky.
Everybody's equal. Nobody's better than nobody else. Rich or poor, don't matter. That's the way we think around here. That's the way it should be.
Producing Inside Appalachia this week from WKYU in Bowling Green, Kentucky, WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky, The Hollywood Reporter, NPR, PRI's The Takeaway, and WNYC. Music in today's show was provided by Sam Gleaves, Andy Agnew Jr., Jake Sheps, the Glenville State Bluegrass Band, Bob Marley with One Love, and Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or WV Jessica Y. Lilly.
Out of this heavy heart of mine, it would sound like going home on a sweet Virginia night. It would wrap around my heart like a honeysuckle vine. And wherever.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.